Where There's a Will, the podcast series From a Lust for Life, is brought to you by Revive Active, Ireland's all-natural super supplements, formulated by scientists and delivering real benefits.
You're listening to Where There's a Will, a podcast from A Lust for Life about the mental health system in Ireland. In this six-part series, we ask why our mental health system is so dysfunctional, who is responsible for making change happen, and how we can collectively respond, join the dots, and make things better for all of us. I'm Paula McLaughlin.
And I'm Ciara O'Connor. And in this series, we'll be tackling some tough issues and sharing stories about mental health which may be difficult to hear. If you or someone you know needs immediate help or is in crisis, phone the free Pieta House 24-hour suicide helpline on 1800 247 247 or text HELP to 51444. Or if you just need to talk, you can contact the Samaritans, Aware or your local GP.
In this episode, we're going to look at Irish mental health policy. We dive into its details and we untangle its logic. We'll examine our mental health system's architectural drawings, the political drivers behind it, where it has fallen down, and what is needed now in 2018 to create a new roadmap for Ireland's mental health. But let's start by casting your mind back to 2006. If I lay here. Eddie Hobbs is on TV giving us 30 things to do with our SSIAs. The country is bristling with optimism. The economy is on the up. 85,000 jobs are created. We ate jumbo breakfast rolls, were glued to Bebo, and grappled with hair extensions and giant sunglasses. There were some small whisperings of the economic crash, but Bertie and the boys reassured us it was all guff. Or at the very least, we were in for a soft landing.
And part of this optimism and sense of invincibility must have hung in the air as a group of smart, committed and energetic people came together to develop a revolutionary new direction for mental health in Ireland. This group of people trying to do the right thing, trying to create something remarkable, something that would be life-changing for so many Irish citizens. They were the expert group on mental health policy, and they created a landmark plan for our mental health system.
A Vision for Change was going to revolutionise our mental health services. It was heralded as a major milestone in Irish public policy. It was person-centred, recovery-oriented, holistic, community-based, multidisciplinary and population-based. Advocacy groups, campaigners and mental health service providers alike all rejoiced. People dared to believe that perhaps a corner had finally been turned in a sector that had been neglected, a sector that had had no major policy revisions since 1984. But A Vision for Change was launched at a perfect moment.
Just as our economy was about to crash.
The bottom fell out of the economy and Vision for Change was ultimately doomed.
In fact, if you see a mental health policy being published, it's probably a good time to sell your shares, sell your house and leave the country for a short while. Because we had the same experience when Planning for the Future, the previous document was launched. It also heralded, you know, cutbacks and severe retraction in services. So Vision for Change is an excellent comprehensive document with lots of really good ideas, internationally admired. But it arrived exactly at the wrong moment for the Irish economy.
This is Martin Rogan again, head of Mental Health Ireland and formerly one of the heads of mental health in the HSE. Martin gives us a bit of history of mental health policy in Ireland.
Interestingly, there's been three major policy statements in the last 50 years. So there was a big commission of inquiry in 1966, which really set a course for responding to people in their own homes, in their own communities, and not disrupting people's lives by admitting them to hospital, sometimes for very long periods. And these messages again were restated in 1984 in a policy document called Planning for the Future. And again, it set a course for the community, suggested if you must be an inpatient, that should be in an acute hospital setting. And, you know, families and others and NGOs and other organisations should be more actively involved in a rounded response to the person's needs. These messages, again, are echoed in A Vision for Change in 2006. So there's nothing magical or new. The question is, if you continually are restating these topics, the question is, why weren't they implemented?
Over the intervening decade, there was a growing frustration that it had proven to be so difficult to make Vision for Change a reality on the ground. And especially given many of the principles of Vision for Change have been knocking around for decades, sitting on shelves gathering dust.
And oftentimes there was a sense of disbelief, sometimes there was an issue around resource, and sometimes there was just an extraordinary inertia that things will continue as they've always been.
Picture that expert group who spent so long carefully considering what a modern, caring and person-centred mental health service might look like. Imagine their optimism slowly ebbing away as months go by, timescales are pushed out, budgets shrink, recruitment bans come into effect. The vision in A Vision for Change becomes blurry and distorted, a distant glimmer of an alternate reality. Think about how they must feel years later when they see that their vision in A Vision for Change is still just that, a vision. It's a tragic story of a plan that had the potential to change so many people's lives for the better, but which ultimately has been left to rot. There's been two big problems that have plagued Vision for Change since day one. Number one, funding, and number two, leadership. Any progress we've seen over the past decade has been piecemeal. And now that the recession has passed, we're left with this great document, albeit 12 years old and in need of a reboot. Vision for Change 2.0 is being developed at the moment. But will the same problems continue to hang over the newest iteration? Will the obstacles that made A Vision for Change fail in the first instance be addressed? We're trying to pick up the pieces 12 years later, and things are even worse now. We have even more staff shortages and more demand for services. Are we doomed to repeat Ireland's legacy of a mental health boom-bust cycle, full of ambitious and carefully crafted policy documents that ultimately go nowhere? Mental Health Reform are an organisation which exists to drive change in the mental health system in Ireland. And we spoke to Shari McDade, their director, who expressed her frustration with the slowness of implementing Vision for Change.
I mean, people are not categories. People are life journeys and life experiences. It really doesn't make sense to split off the help that they need into different silos and have those silos not working together and providing, from the individual's perspective, a coherent, comprehensive support. So to me, that's quite basic. And the irony is that how hard it is to get that delivered. That's what's so ironic, because in fact it's been policy since 2006. It's in our national mental health policy that people should have coordinated care, that they should have comprehensive care. That's all in there, that they should have person-centered care, centered around the needs of the individual. But in practice, it seems very, very difficult to get that delivered.
Many of the solutions are already described in Vision for Change. You know, there's very little in Vision for Change that you would cast out.
The Vision for Change that existed in 2006 was a fantastic document. It was a policy document with deliverables.
Of itself, Vision for Change is quite a good model. Of course, there are faults and weaknesses in it, and I hope the review that's happening now will correct that.
John Saunders again, Chair of the Mental Health Commission and CEO of Shine.
But sometimes people say, blame the fact that it's not implemented on the model itself. I don't think that's true. As it was launched in 2006, everybody said it was great. And everybody said they would support it. Now, the monitoring group reports between 2006 and 2012 show a very sorry tale of very, very poor implementation. There were many, many attempts at implementation, both at Department of Health and HSE level, and it didn't work. In other words, very little happened in those early years. What needs to be done now is a focus on implementation, to look at the pieces of vision that weren't implemented. Not the ones that didn't work, because that's a different thing. There may be pieces that didn't work, and that's fine, you need to question that. But most of vision didn't work because it wasn't actually implemented. So there was never a chance for it to fail or succeed. Now, that's not new. Ireland is very poor at policy implementation across the board, but it's particularly obvious in mental health. And I'm hopeful that the review that's happening now will not only identify the pieces of vision policy that need to be changed, but we'll actually go further and make some very strong statements about how we do it. And in the middle of vision is this notion of cultural change. I don't think it's been touched. That's one of the issues that hasn't been dealt. And in a sense, it's a bit like, you know, you can't really repair a house if you don't get something fundamental right, like making sure the foundations are right or it's damp-proof or something. You can fiddle around with it, doing small things, but you really need to do some fundamental work to make a house that wasn't livable in, now livable. It's a bit the same with policy. You need to go to some core fundamental elements and change those before you go any further.
I think one of the problems, we were discussing it earlier, is that we do set out nice policy documents, but then we don't follow through on them for whatever way.
Dr. John Hillary, President of the Irish College of Psychiatrists.
And then there's a suspicion about what other people are doing. So, and we want everyone to speak the same type of language and to have the same kind of culture. Mm-hmm. So you have the doctors and the administrators saying, well, a doctor wouldn't know about that. They don't think about the money. They don't think about this. And then we have the doctors saying, well, the administrator doesn't understand what we have to do. And it ends up being two different silos with people opposed to each other instead of people complementing each other with their different skills.
Gary Fitzgibbon is like a mental health Batman. He's had depression for a number of years and he's been in and out of the system. His story is scarily similar to a lot of people's. Crap access to service, inadequate care, no empathy, no focus on recovery. The complete opposite of a vision for change's model. Now he's a mental health advocate. He's investigating a number of issues with his own case, specifically why he wasn't offered any form of counselling in 5 years. He helps other people through the system. He told me his story.
I've been really outspoken in my criticisms of the mental health service, and I'd say since February, like, I've been over in an insomnia coffee shop beside my house. I've been over there twice a week at least, meeting different people who don't know where to go, don't know what to do. I don't know the majority of these people, but some of them I went to school with 15 years ago who I haven't spoken to since then. There's others that I know through the GA club or the golf club, others that are friends of my fiance who haven't even told my fiance the way they are. You know, it's people that I've literally never met before in my life, and they're just stuck in limbo. They don't know what to do. It's almost a year to the day since I tried to take my own life. That was after being in the mental health system for just over 5 years, with a diagnosis of clinical depression. I haven't looked back in the last 12 months, thankfully. Like, I do believe that the attempted suicide was a product of not being treated correctly. Like, in five and a half years, it was just prescription after prescription, medicating me up to the eyeballs, wasn't working. For a lot of that time, I wasn't helping things either. I was drinking excessively, and there was even a bit of drugs for a small while. And that all came from, you know, within the actual system itself and with the psychiatrists, I was just constantly getting labelled. They were telling me I had addiction problems. They were sending me off to sleep specialists, giving me more medication. No matter what ailment I had, they were trying to medicate it. And I argued with them the whole time that I didn't have addiction problems and I wouldn't get addiction counselling because I told them I wasn't an addict. I was dependent on it for quite a while because it was the only relief I was getting. But their approach most definitely wasn't working. The problems with the psychiatrists are just never ending. They've got some sort of a revolving door system. In the day hospital in Shannon, anyway, I think, I stand corrected, but I think it's 6 months that is the most any psychiatrist, apart from the consultant, is allowed to spend there. So every 6 months for the last 5 years, I'm going in and I'm going back to square one and starting my whole story from scratch, and that's quite draining in itself, you know? I think the idea of them doing that revolving door system is so that you don't build up a relationship. From day one, it's been disaster after disaster until this day. It continues on until this day.
Do you remember the first day you went in there?
Yeah. I went in there and I was out, I think, in less than 7 minutes. There's no regard for the background or what might have led to this. It's all based on this theory that it's a chemical imbalance and we're going to medicate you to fix it, which personally I think is an absolute load of shit. It was all emotional kind of stuff that all turned inward and it took over for a finish. The first time I went there, it was obviously a traumatic enough kind of experience. I'd never been to visit anyone in a psychiatric unit or anything. And I think there was people an awful lot worse than me in the sense that they were a lot more aggressive, or, you know, I found them really difficult to be around when you're contemplating taking your own life, or it can make it worse. I think I came out worse than what I did going in. To show you how bad things are in that part of the country, last October I took an overdose and I was brought by an ambulance to the regional in Limerick. I was assessed after a few hours on a trolley by a crisis nurse and discharged, which I was okay with, discharged with my parents. And I was told I'd have contact from my community team within 48 hours to arrange follow-up. Never happened. I waited nearly 2 weeks after attempting suicide before going over to the day hospital myself, where they admitted me to the hospital for the psychiatric unit for 3 weeks. It turned out the crisis nurse never entered my attendance at A&E in the system. So, you know, how often is this happening? I've spoke out about this. It's been in newspapers in Clare umpteen times in the last few months, and I'm still getting people contacting me saying the exact same thing is happening there. Like, this is all stuff that nobody hears about unless you're actually in the system yourself, you know.
The kind of problems Gary faced would not have been there, or at least they wouldn't have been as severe, if Vision for Change had ever become a reality. He would have been offered multidisciplinary care, holistic support, and would have been treated as a partner in his diagnosis and recovery. I asked him what the difference would have been for him.
I wouldn't have lost 6 years of my life, so I genuinely feel like I have.
If Vision for Change 2.0 is going to work, one of the key things it'll need is leadership, both internally in the system and, crucially, political leadership. But the question remains, are there any votes in mental health? Even if they wanted to, can our government really impact the culture of the HSE? How can we create political will to get Vision for Change and other structural changes needed off the ground? Do our politicians care about mental health at all?
I really, at a core level, believe that mental health services aren't that important to people. We have a lot of talk about them. We have a lot of people who are very well-meaning. We also have a lot of passionate people. But at the highest level, I think it's important for people in public life to talk about mental health, but I don't think they really feel it's that important.
Professor John Hillary again.
I mean, the people who can make a difference, not just politicians. I wonder about the HSE's motivations and how much control do politicians have over the HSE? Very little, I'd say. And even though I grew up at the time of the health boards and people were critical of that and there was too much political interference, at least there was some political accountability in the health boards. And there were people on the health boards who were elected officials who had to answer to their electorate. No one answers from the HSE now. They don't even answer to the minister. And there is no board of the HSE anymore. So anyone running the HSE has no board even to answer to. And James Riley is to blame for that. He got rid of that, but he didn't replace it with anything, didn't bring in accountability. And in the old health boards then you had GPs and you had doctors and you had people who could represent patients. That's all gone. There's four four or five areas of the country, but they can't do anything. I know people who go to them, counsellors, and they say it's just a talking shop. And in Ireland we're bogged down in confusing outcomes with process. Process with outcomes. Right. And that's across the health service and in other ways too. So if you hear a minister talk about what they've done in health, they'll say, we opened so many more units, we opened so many more outpatients. Now, in psychiatry, it's difficult to quantify that because you can't stand beside a nice psychiatry machine and say, the minister is opening this today. The minister can't go into his department in the morning and the civil servant get praise from the minister for developing a new psychiatry machine. So there isn't much to show from that point of view. There aren't many photo ops with the outcomes, because the outcomes are people who don't need to be photographed anymore because they're back in society. It needs leadership, I think, at the top level. And if you look back to our template, which is a Vision for Change, it's now over 10 years old now. And one of the things in that was to be a leader. There was to be a leader, a bit like Sláinte Care, and it didn't happen. They didn't appoint. We saw how the cancer services improved with the cancer czar, to use the cliche or the term that was used. That was meant to happen in mental health services. It didn't happen. And what they did do was they set up a pillar in the HSE. But the trouble is with that, first of all, a lot of our mental health services are a low percentage, but an important percentage, are outside the HSE. And if you had any meetings with the HSE about Vision for Change, they didn't want to acknowledge that. It had to be a HSE thing. Then they set up the pillar, and now they've got rid of it. So there was a mental health pillar in the HSE structure, and the last CEO of the HSE abolished that. I don't know of any larger organisation in the world that would allow a HSE to say he or she was leaving and then allow them to change the governance of the organisation. It would be at odds with good practice in the private sector, but we allow that to happen in the biggest employer in Ireland. If you look at it as a business, it's the biggest business in Ireland. The CEO was leaving, changed all the governance structure, and then left. No business would allow that to happen. And one of the things that happened, and I, among others, have been going on about this, is that the mental health pillar was got rid of. The person who was the lead of that, who is an occupational therapist by training, but is a very good administrator, and we worked very well with her. She's been, because she's so good, she's been moved to be in charge of several things now, which is what happens in Ireland.
Progress has been made. Last year, we were campaigning for out-of-hours mental health services. We told the minister that we thought that a good first step would be to ensure that every adult mental health service was available 7 days a week. He committed to making that happen this year. We understand that recruitment is going on in terms of getting the staff in to be able to make sure that all of those community mental health services around the country are open 7 days a week. We have lost some of the focus and focal point for making that progress because we used to have a head of the mental health services in the HSE, and we don't have a head of the mental health services in the HSE anymore. So that's really scary now. It's a concern for a lot of people involved in the whole area of mental health that we don't have one person in the HSE who controls the mental health budget, who controls the delivery of the policy and has the authority to ensure that that policy is delivered around the country. That's now been broken up. We used to have one. She was called the National Director for Mental Health, and that post, that role no longer exists in the HSE as of January of this year. So now we have each community healthcare organization around the country is essentially responsible for delivering on mental health in their area. And there's someone in centrally in the HSE who looks after the operations of all of that, and there's a separate person in the HSE who looks after strategy. It's a little bit confusing, and it's a little bit worrying, because it's very hard to hold the HSE to account when there isn't a clear person who has the responsibility. I think that hampers then what the minister can do, because the minister has to have a clear channel through to the HSE to hold the HSE to account himself, you know? And I think it's very important that we strengthen the accountability of the HSE to the Minister for Health and the Minister for Mental Health. I think that's definitely going to be part of the challenge going into the future about getting change delivered.
Gary Fitzgibbons again.
But the whole system from the top down it's not fit for purpose. Like I say, I got invited to the Dáil a few weeks ago, and it was Jim Daly invited me up there. It wasn't that I asked to go up and talk to him. So before I went up, and on the way up, I was really upbeat about it. I was like, geez, maybe this fella wants to, you know, have a positive impact or whatever. And I went up there and I told him my story and everything, and his response the whole time was, I can't comment on a clinical decision. So I'm going, okay. And he said it about four times. And then I said, is there anyone in your department who can? And he said, no, we can't pass comment on clinical decisions. So we've actually got a ministry there for mental health, and none of those in charge of it are allowed to question what a psychiatrist does.
I used to have a cartoon when I did presentations as president of the Medical Council, which was from the New Yorker, and it showed a patient in a bed with a doctor beside the bed, and the doctor was dressed as a Royal Canadian Mounted Policeman, and the doctor was saying to the patient, this year we're using the Canadian model. And that's the trouble. People who work in the Canadian model say to me that it's good in some things but not good in others. So we need an Irish model. We have the trained people. We have a blueprint and a vision for change, which is being reviewed at the moment. We have people in need, and we just need to develop an Irish model that suits our culture. What we want to do is get people back into society. Because of cycles of news, elections, budgets, everything has to be done in the next month. So we need to show something to the electorate next month. Yeah. So we can show that we opened a clinic in Ennis, we opened a clinic in Tella, we can show that. We've been doing our work. Yeah. Instead of saying, well, and I know Sláinte Care is meant to get around this, but we wait to see how much they really believe in that too, because we know the Taoiseach didn't turn up for the launch of it. We know certain things have changed in it already. So there was meant to be one czar based in the Taoiseach's office, which would give them the power to tell finance and health what to do. Yeah. They're not going to be based in the Taoiseach's office or finance. They're back in health. So we have to wait to see what happens there. But the idea there was to get out of this cycle and have a long-term approach. And that's what we need. But it needs to be backed up, as it would in any business, with a financial approach that matches that. So we have a vision for change, which was a long-term view to how psychiatric services should be delivered. It was about recovery. It was about patients as partners. It was about making sure people had mentally healthy lives. It hasn't happened. We're 10 years on. It hasn't been delivered. It was meant to have a leadership that wasn't developed, but it never had a financial timeline alongside the other timeline.
It's pretty unusual for the head of an organisation like the Mental Health Commission to blast the government and the HSE in the media. Usually these are the kinds of conversations that happen discreetly behind closed doors between ministers and their advisory bodies. But this year, John Saunders, chair of the Mental Health Commission, had enough.
The commission was writing the annual report that has come out a couple of months ago. And when I was writing the introduction, which I normally do every year, I realised I was writing the same things that I'd written before. And I was reading the same things that I'd read before. And we went back and we looked at the annual reports from 2012. So that's five reports. And we identified five or six things that hadn't changed. That's when the penny dropped. That, in fact, what I was saying was nothing new. I had said this publicly before. And I can tell you without looking at it, the issues were the lack of individualised programme plans for people. A plan around what's going to happen to me when I get into my service. Like you have a medical plan in your hospital if you go in for surgery. Children being inappropriately admitted to adult units, one in five, roughly. That's been going on for the last 5 years, probably longer, because we started measuring it properly. The amount of control and restraint that's used, restrictive practices that are used, lack of appropriate staffing, and more importantly, the lack of very specific training for those staff who are in place. So they're the types of headline issues which, and I look back, I could see all this, and there was, I suppose, a sense of exasperation and say, why do we keep saying this? And this is where I made the point in the report that there was a sense that we were saying all of this, but no one's listening. Providers weren't listening at a global level. Government appeared not to be listening, and particularly the Department of Health and the Minister appeared not to be listening, in the sense that there was no proactive responses to these issues. Yes, it might have been a bit louder this year, but it was, in a sense, an echoing of what has been identified for many, many years. I suppose I also took the view that, look, the state, society, has created the Mental Health Commission. It's paying for the Mental Health Commission. This is what it should be doing. And I wasn't particularly worried about offending anybody. I'm not doing it for my own gain or for any other reason. The only reason I'm doing it is that's what's expected of the Commission. I was asked to do this job. There are Commission members who are asked to do it. There are people working in the Commission who are paid to do it. And that's the job of the Commission.
When it comes to mental health, all countries are developing countries. The scale of the problem is estimated to cost the world economy $16 trillion by 2030. the solutions would pay for themselves. But as the title of our podcast asks, is there the will to make that money available? Will there be the resources there to bring new policies to life?
No one would say we don't need money. And no one would say we don't need more money. Of course, the more money you get, the better you can do things, because money is a tangible resource. It's how you use the money is the issue. And we sometimes can be seen to throw good money after bad if we have a model and a structure that's not working, and we just throw money at it to try and make it work by engaging more of the same. We can never actually say we have enough money or we don't need more money, but it's how you use the money is the important bit, and that's the bit that's not often thought out properly.
But is there a will or is there the money? I mean, the other thing I keep asking, but no one answers me, is maybe the country is broke and we can't afford this. But why don't you just come out and say that, Minister Taoiseach said? And yet at the same time, we're going to have a new connection to the airport, I think, aren't we, which is going to cost millions?
Again, Shari McDade.
It's funny because this debate tends to be positioned very much in terms of whether money is the answer. Our funding in this country for mental health is still relatively low, despite all of the additional investment that was made in a small period of time between 2012 and 2018, compared to much better performing mental health services. Our nearest neighbor, England, has typically had about 12 to 13% of its health budget going to mental health. We have about 6%. We're not putting in the amount of funding that would generate the kind of vision that we have, which is of easily accessible mental health services. Even in 2018, we're still spending less on our mental health services than we were in 2008, before the crisis. The quote-unquote additional funding that we've gotten is still only been to make up the ground that we lost in the economic crisis. We just almost have the number of staff that we had in the services in 2008. We still actually have a little bit fewer staff in the service than we had in 2008. And there's been a big increase in demand. And wonderfully that people are coming forward to say, I'm ready to ask for help now for my mental health, but the services still have the same number of staff that they had in 2008. Mental health reform is absolutely clear. We do need more investment in mental health. We need to keep improving the resources that we have in mental health. We need to extend those resources beyond the traditional mental health services. So we need to make sure that we have enough staff in those specialist mental health services. We also need to greatly expand our service for people who just need short-term therapy. So we have a national free service for people who need short-term therapy. It's called the Counseling and Primary Care Service, but it's only for people on medical cards. And it only covers at the moment about 15,000. Let's say there's a little bit of an estimate, but say about 15,000 people a year. Okay, so if we figured that there are upwards of more than 300,000 people in Ireland every year who are going through a mental health difficulty, we can see that there are thousands and thousands of people who don't have access to that free therapy, which would keep their mental health from getting worse, maybe resolve their issue very quickly, and get them back into life, never having to go near the mental health services. So we need to hugely ramp up our investment in that kind of service to get lots of people to have much more easy access to counseling and psychotherapy. We need to invest in our advocacy services. I think we need to invest in our not-for-profit, in our NGO community services around the country, which suffered a lot during the crisis and which haven't all been restored to their full funding either. But to recognize all those community groups as essential partners in keeping people well and keeping people in good mental health. So I can't make sense, actually, of the idea that we have enough money in our mental health. Not when I know the waiting list, the demands, the huge areas of need that are not met. I can't make sense of that. The other thing that we really want people to understand is that it's not a cost. Putting money into mental health is not actually a cost, because it saves money. And there's really, really good evidence to show that for every euro, for instance, that you invest in helping people with a mental health difficulty, who maybe have a physical health difficulty as well, that you save four. You know, it's very good value for money to invest in mental health. It keeps people in work if they are in work. It keeps people able to care for others if they're in a caring role. It keeps people in housing. It helps young people not to end up in the prison system if they get support early. So there are lots and lots of good reasons why investing in mental health will save costs elsewhere in our big public budget. So that's where we are very passionate about it, as you can see.
The WHO, World Health Organization, would very clearly say if you plan to have any mental health service, you need to dedicate 12% of the health budget to that.
Again, Martin Rogan.
Any less than that, you're actually confusing the picture. You know, you really shouldn't even dabble with that. Just don't even enter the fray. 12% is the entry point. When Vision for Change was published, it was 7.6%. And even the policy only set the target at 8.4%. Still, you know, only two-thirds what WHO would recommend. And during our recession, because there was a massive flight of staff and the loss of resource that went with that, this number dropped to 6%. So it's not realistic to expect if you put, you know, half a tank of petrol into your car that you're going to be able to go on a long journey and get back. So if you simply half resource the service, it's no great rocket science to discover that there will be inadequacy, there will be issues about access, and there will be quality concerns. Money is a solution, and money in terms of what you do with that money. My own training includes some training in health economics. And you can wail about the level of resource, but you have to say the resource is the resource. And if this is all we have, are we putting it to the best use? In fairness to our Victorian colleagues, they used their best technology and they put an extraordinary amount of resource into responding to mental health need. Unfortunately, I don't think our generation will be accused of doing our best, using our best technology, or marshalling significant resource. And if that's the actuality, and some research done by the Mental Health Commission and NUIG in Galway demonstrates that really the public, while there's a lot of hand-wringing around mental health, when it comes to actually putting your hands into your pockets and contributing, there isn't the same appetite for that.
The issues in the system aren't just bad for people accessing services. They're bad too for the people who work in the services. If money isn't flowing and the staff are overworked, yet under pressure to do more and more, that's not good. Deprive any organ of the oxygen it needs to function, and it won't be long before it stops working altogether.
You really can only do what you're funded to do. And after a while, it's very difficult to stay in the hero mode. So people will become deflated, will become tired, can become jaded, and very easily become cynical. There are about 10,000 people who go to work every day in the mental health service in Ireland, and they resist that temptation. But I wouldn't count on that for too long.
I'm sorry to come back to resources, but in a certain way, when services and staff in those services are stretched to the point where they feel that they're just keeping things together with Band-Aids all the time to try and keep things going, it's very hard to think about improving quality and new initiatives and new approaches and, you know, something like let's not turn anyone away when you feel like you can barely cope with the number of people that are coming to your door at the moment. There is kind of a catch-22 here. You have to put the investment in, but you have to tie that investment to real change. But it's no point in saying, well, I want you to change, but I'm not giving you the resources to do the changes you need to make. So I think it's quite reasonable to have very clear expectations about any additional funding that goes in, that it should be tied to specific targets, to specific programs, that, as you say, business cases, to use the business language, need to be made in terms of very clear plans for how that funding will be used. I think it's possible to do that. I think it's possible for the Minister for Mental Health to require that kind of clarity from the HSE before handing the money over. And then you have a good relationship there. You have the commitment to the money if the HSE can show how they're going to use it and can show how they're going to keep track of it. We can see the outcomes from that expenditure.
So what is needed in terms of leadership and funding and policy direction? Well, in July 2017, a group of elected representatives got together and formed a joint Oireachtas committee on the future of mental health. They spoke to people at every level of service provision, advocacy groups and people who'd used the system. They asked them all the same question. What needs to change?
We have seen the huge change in Ireland that we now have a national parliamentary committee on mental health. That's one of the few in the world that has ever done that, to have a parliamentary committee on mental health. So that's really powerful, and it shows that our politicians recognize that it's an issue, that they're interested, but now it's time to make sure that they deliver and to show them they have to up their game, that we're smart. We are smart enough to be able to tell whether things in mental health in this country are really improving or not really improving, and that we're going to hold them to account for that.
Senator Joan Freeman chaired this committee, and we asked her to explain, first of all, exactly what a joint committee is and does, as well as giving us an overview of what they learned in this process of talking to the entire mental health sector over the course of a number of months.
What a joint Oireachtas committee means is that there are members, there are deputies and senators from all the parties that are coming together to form a committee who will focus on mental health. It's the first time we've ever had one in the history of the state. It's the first time we think in Europe. There's three areas that we really, really need to focus on. The first one is primary care and the realisation that 90% of all mental health issues can be seen at primary care. The second thing was recruitment. The tragedy is our nurses, our psychiatric nurses and our psychiatrists are leaving the services in their droves. And we try to find out what's wrong. What are we doing wrong in Ireland? And of course, you know, the excuse from the HSE was that this is a global problem. It's not. And if it is, then let the globe handle it. We're talking about Ireland. And the problem here in Ireland is the process to recruit somebody is so complicated. It takes a year just to put in an ad, to interview and to place somebody. A year. And even then, when a psychiatrist or a psychiatric nurse is applying for a job, they have no idea where they will be placed in any part of the country. It is almost as if it is made more difficult deliberately. So the other thing is that the environment that nurses and psychiatrists have to work in are appalling. I mean, I'm not trying to depress everybody over this, but this is the reality. So that's the second part the committee are trying to focus on. What's wrong with the way you're recruiting? So the third one then that we're focusing on is basically accountability. And what I mean by accountability in relation to funding. Yeah. So we've been asking the HSE to come in. How are you spending this? How are you spending that? And in particular, again, we started coming back to CAMHS, you know, the children's services. How are you spending that? And they can't answer. They say they don't have the software to account how every penny is spent. And we are just looking absolutely amazed at this. I mean, if any company in Ireland, any charity in Ireland said, sorry, we don't have the software, what do you think would happen? So we're discovering all these things and trying to deal with them. We've had very, very emotional meetings that have gone on, not only with the people who's giving presentations, but also some of the members of the Oireachtas Committee. But the problem is, it lacks political will. And the thing is, you know, I think there's something like 12,000 reports on the same issues. And what makes me laugh is that, you know, and even our own committee, I was saying, what in God's name are we adding another report to the 12,000 reports? But the only thing is that there are people, some people on the committee who will be very, very vocal about the reports, who will keep banging on, and I hope that continues on. We should be able to do it with the right support and with the right motivation and the right will.
Think about those 12,000 reports with recommendation after recommendation, all echoing Vision for Change, which in turn was echoing the previous policy document, none of which were enacted. And our politicians preside over these decades of inertia with zero accountability to be found anywhere. How can we make sense of all of this? It really feels like this big, massive juggernaut of a system is beyond control, like it has a life of its own, all these different heads pulling in different directions. I almost feel bad for a politician who's put at the helm knowing little to nothing about mental health. It's an absolute quagmire.
So what can you do? What can I do? What can any of us do about this? It kind of feels too big to fix, doesn't it? It feels like there's so many problems, and we've heard about so many of them in the last two episodes. Inhumanity, the use of coercive control, lack of empathy and training, right up to systemic problems like lack of access to care, people being turned away, children in adult units, and lack of joined up systems and accountability. But what is clear is that all of these problems boil down to a lack of leadership, no will, and no drive to make change happen. And of course, no resources to back it up. We need to make Vision for Change 2.0 happen. The only way we can effectively make it happen, though, is by arming it with the tools and resources to drive it forward. There needs to be accountability, individuals and services that are expected to deliver against budgets and against timelines. And what will drive all of that is political will. A minister in a department who are committed, who will crack the whip and cut through the bullshit and entrenched bureaucracy. And how do we find that political will to change? By making noise.
The people of Ireland have to be the conscience of the government. And we're already doing that, taking back the city on Saturday, that march. God, that was extraordinary. Last week I was at a march down in Wexford town, where parents were demanding services for their children. That is exactly 200,000 people have walked across Ireland this year for suicide. You know, that is how we draw attention, we embarrass them, but we keep at, we don't do it once. We keep doing it until they do something about it.
I think that we have a responsibility, everyone who cares about mental health, to start telling our politicians that we understand that mental health is a little bit complicated, but it's still worth doing. And I think that we'll find that lots of people in Ireland understand that mental health is a little bit of a slow-burning kind of a issue, that it takes time, that it takes investment, but that they want to see that investment. Politicians, I think they really need to wake up to the fact that people in Ireland care about mental health. My sense is that our politicians are just a little bit behind the curve, that they don't realize how much people care about mental health in this country. And I think they're going to be surprised when they find out, when they figure out that actually people in Ireland really want there to be adequate support for someone who's going through a tough time with their mental health. If we put more of a priority on Ireland's mental health, a lot of other things will become easier. I think the best way to get it over the line is exactly what we're doing today, talking about it, but getting people to talk to their politicians and to tell them that that they care about mental health services, that they want to see investment, that they want to see greater accountability for the mental health services and delivery and implementation of the vision that we all share. Politics is a bit kind of simple in a way. Politicians respond to noise. They respond to the concerns. I mean, they are accountable to their constituents, so they respond to what their constituents raise to them as issues. You know, they want to get reelected, which is great. They want to keep doing things that make a difference to their community. And there are lots of different competing concerns that come across their desks every day. And so it's only if we really start saying it to them that they start to listen. Yeah. So this is certainly not the time to give up. This is the time to keep going.
Looking back over the last number of major social shifts in Ireland, we all know it's been people's stories that made the difference. People like Gary, who are just sick of the failures in the system, and who bear the brunt of the stigma and the fallout to speak up and just speak up loudly for what they know needs to change. Our silence has been a great hiding place for our system's failures. But now it feels that we're at a point where shame and fear have simply lost their power. People are ready to speak up and say, hey, look, I had a mental health problem and how it was handled, it actually made me worse. And I hope that our leaders are ready to start listening, to start leading, and to start investing in mental health, because they are the ones that need to drive this. They are the ones that need to make the vision of a changed mental health system a reality. In the next episode, we're going to look at our society, the stigmas and the challenges that contribute to our collective mental health, and how we can change things for the better in our homes, in our families, in our communities, in our country. Next week on Where There's a Will.
Thanks for listening to Where There's a Will, a podcast from A Lust for Life. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review us on iTunes, or just tell a friend about us. Also, we want to hear from you. Have you had experiences with the system, good or bad, that you'd like to share? Or have you ideas on how we can make things better, easier and faster for people to get help? Send us a short voice recording to editor@alustforlife.com, or just record a WhatsApp voice note and text it to 083-119-0269. That's 083-119-0269.
And just as a reminder, if you have been affected by any of the issues raised by this podcast, there is help available. If you or someone you know needs immediate help or is in crisis, phone the free Pieta House 24-hour suicide helpline on 1800 247 247 or text HELP to 51444. If you just need to talk, you can also contact the Samaritans, Aware, or your local GP. Check out alustforlife.com for contact information for all of the support available.
Where There's a Will, the podcast series from A Lust for Life, is brought to you by Revive Active, Ireland's all-natural super supplements, formulated by scientists and delivering real benefits.